So good day to folks online. Sorry, I'm a few minutes late today. Happy Diwali. So all the folks here at Harris Park are struggling to find anywhere to park. So anyone who stayed home, then that's probably wise for today. But anyway. So I'm Bhante Sujato. So we do have sound, just to confirm, we have sound? We're good? Okay. So I'm Bhante Sujato, and we are here on the land of the Burramadigal people of the Darug Nation and pay respects to the elders past, present, and emerging. And for tonight, we're going to have some chanting, some devotional chanting for the Buddha. We're going to do some meditation. We're going to have some Dhamma talk and some chant for some questions. And for the folks online, if you do have any questions, then please feel free to pop them into the chat and I will see how I go with answering them. Let us begin with some chanting in honor to the Triple Gem.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi, tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Itipiso bhagavarahaṃ sammasambuddho vijjacharana sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa dhamma sarathi sattha deva manusanam buddho bhagavati svakato bhagavata dhammo sandirthiko akaliko ehi pasiko opanayiko pacatam veditabo vinyuhiti. Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho. Ujjupatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho. Nyāyapatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho. Samīcipatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho. Yadidaṃ cattāri purisa yugāni Atta purisa pungala esa bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho. Ahu Dharam Punyaketam Lokasati.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good, welcome. Actually, can we open the windows and or doors as much as we can? It's pretty warm tonight. Noma's asking how to get the camera on. Noma, there is a bar at the bottom of your screen which you can click to get the camera on if that's in your problem in your browser. Otherwise, if it's a problem, maybe it's a problem in the settings on your computer, in which case we can't help you. Sorry. Okay, very good. Is that good enough? The air? Do you want to open the door as well? What do you reckon? What do you think? It's pretty warm. Is it? Let's see. Let's open the door. If it's too noisy, we will shut it. Is that? Is there? Well, let's leave it just for now. And if it's there's a breeze. Breeze is always better than aircon if we can. All right. So time to do some meditation. Yes? Remember what meditation's all about. Who can tell me what's meditation about? You guys came to my retreat last year. What's meditation about? You guys know? Don't tell me I've been just wasting my time. Good question, he says. Okay. So, go on, yeah?
The best way I can explain it is the analogy you mentioned once where you make some tea and you just watch the lake without actually trying to stir it until the mud settles.
Okay.
So you kind of allow it to settle, you watch it. Okay.
Okay, thank you. You have been paying attention. That's excellent. So I said that meditation is like a lake, is an analogy I use sometimes, where you just, rather than muddle about in the lake trying to clear the water, you just sit beside it peacefully and allow the water to settle by itself. And so meditation is allowing your mind to find that sense of peace. Yeah? This is really important, I think, to understand how meditation works. Because when we look into our mind, what we usually see is our mind is full of agitation, full of worry, full of all these things. And that, we take that to be normal, okay? I mean, it kind of is normal in the sense of being average, right? Kind of most of the time, most people are like that. But it's also normal to be at peace, actually. And there's nothing inherently strange or difficult or unnatural about the mind simply being at peace. So a process of meditation really is a process of doing as little as possible to just kind of nudge our mind gently to a place where it can find that peace. So when we set up meditation, what we're trying to do is to establish conditions that will make your mind feel safe and feel at ease. Okay? And we do that by the whole context of meditation. We do that by sitting down, doing some chanting. We do it by clarifying the intention in our mind. We do it by having a place. We do it by our posture. We do it by having a time that's reasonably going to be free from distractions and so on. And we give ourselves the permission to just do nothing for this period of time. Right? Just do nothing for this period of time. And so all of that is a way of reassuring your mind that it's in a safe place and that whatever happens in that place is okay. And when your mind feels safe and reassured like that, it starts to get ready to be able to settle down. Now, that process of settling down it's complicated. It takes lots of different turns and it'll be very individual for everyone. So we be patient, we continue, and just keep going. So we need some faith. We need some faith that what we're doing is going in the right direction. We need some faith that somehow it works. We need to have a bit of faith in ourselves, that we can actually do these things. And this is one of the reasons why at the end of every meditation, I always ask you to reflect back over the meditation, to look at what has actually happened. Because each time you do that, you're reminding yourself, oh yeah, actually this does work. Maybe it only works a tiny, tiny little bit. That's okay, right? If your mind is a little bit more clear and pure and peaceful at the end, it's better than being worse. So being a little bit better is better than being a little bit worse. So even if we can do that little bit, then steadily, 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 things will come together. Have fun parking, Alex? So anything that you can do that's going to help you to do that is going to be useful. And so what you want to try to do is to sort of, part of what establishing a meditation routine is about giving your mind that condition that's going to look forward to, now's going to be my time to meditate. Now I don't have to worry about bills, and I don't have to worry about shopping, and I don't have to worry about cleaning, I don't have to worry about anything. I can just sit and just do nothing for a time. And the more completely that you can do that, then the more easily your meditation will flow. So remember in a practice of meditation that our life... Don't let yourself... It's easy to fall into the trap of thinking that your life is the antagonist of your meditation. I could meditate if only life didn't happen. Right? If only I wasn't so busy. If only I didn't have so many people making demands on me. If only there weren't so many issues I had to deal with. If only there wasn't so much at work. So we get into this thing of thinking, I'm going to use meditation as an escape from all of those things. But that's not how the Buddha taught. The Buddha said that meditation is part of the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path, the entirety of the Noble Eightfold Path, means living your life skillfully and well. And when you live your life skillfully and well, then that is the support for your meditation. It doesn't get in the way of your meditation. Right? So next time you come to meditate, maybe you're sitting at home, you sit down to meditate and you start worrying about your work. I'm stressed because of work. Then just remember, if you didn't have a job, you would be homeless. You need a place to stay. And the fact that you have a place to stay is because you do that work. And that's what makes it possible for you to meditate. So just remind yourself, be grateful. It's good. It's good that I've got a job. It's good that I've got a place to stay. It's good that I've got people around me that care about me. Yeah? It's good that all of these things are there. And it's good that I've had the opportunity to practice all five factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action. And what's the last one? Next one? Right livelihood. Thank you. Right livelihood. Right, all of these five are the foundations of meditation. Right? And then when we come to meditation, these are not our enemies, these are our supports. These are what's buoying us up and supporting up, making it possible for us to meditate. And so one, I always remember one when I was staying in Ipoh many years ago now, and one of the very devoted meditators there, very, very committed, used to go and, you know, do long retreats and all of these kinds of things. And she came up to me one day and she said, you know, we think that like if we really want to get advanced in your practice, and the way to do that is to first like earn a lot of money and then retire and then just go and retreat the whole time. And then she just kind of looked at me and said, but that's not right, is it? I said, no. Because that's still about the future, you know, it's not about the now. So the way to practice is actually to be present, and to be present now. If you get the chance to go on retreat, great. But if not, you're still practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. So for tonight, we're going to do some mindfulness of breathing meditation. Of course, there are thousands of different meditations on different meditation apps, and there's all of these books, thousands of books on it. I'm guilty of writing a few of them myself. And all of these words build on meditation. But if you really want to break it down, the words of the Buddha on meditation, so sato va asasati, sato pasasati. Mindful, one breathes in. Mindful, one breathes out. That's all you have to remember. Okay? Mindful breathing in, mindful breathing out. Good enough. Okay? Now, when you can go home, you can do a whole Marie Kondo and just take all of your meditation books and spark joy by just getting passing them on to someone. And I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that if your meditation books are there to help you. So if they help you, that's good. Right? But actually, it's very simple. So don't make it complicated. Mindfully breathe in, mindfully breathe out. Some things in life are hard. Pali grammar, complicated. Nothing you can do about that, right? But breath meditation, simple. Let's do it. Sitting quietly. So mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. Feeling that soft, gentle movement of the breath. Mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. When your mind starts to wander off, making its fancies and its thoughts, its images, its feelings, emotions, all of that just comes from inside you. It's something that you're doing. So don't worry about it. Don't get frustrated. Just come back to the breath, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. And let the breath take care of you. Let the breath calm you down. Let it soothe you. Let it bring pleasure and peace to every part of you. Okay, so now coming near to the end of the meditation, bring your mind back from the breath into your body, into the touches and sounds, everything around you. And before we finish, we can just recollect back over our meditation. Ask yourself, what's changed? How mindful was I of my breathing in and breathing out? Was I focused, settled, aware, or was I distracted, upset? Disturbed. What does my mind feel like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And finally, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy, may all beings be well, may all beings realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Okay, great. Let's have a bit of a short break, stretch your legs, and we'll come back for the Dhamma talk. That's a heavy metal bell, that's for sure. Okay, in the most literal sense. Okay, fine. Everybody, we are back here today and ready for some Dhamma talk. So we don't have any questions in the chat. Maybe some people here have some questions. I've been doing a lot of sutta readings and things like that. So I just thought today we might be doing something a bit lighter and just a sort of a bit more Q&A and stuff, rather than anything too full on with content. So anyone got any questions? Ah, whatever. What's on your mind? How's things?
Actually, I just came back from Ipoh.
You came back from Ipoh.
Yes,
ah,
very recently.
Nice.
My brother went for a holiday,
okay,
for a tour,
okay,
Greek island,
okay,
and he died there.
Oh my goodness, that was a shocking.
Swimming in those beautiful islands, yeah. And maybe got a heart attack.
Oh my goodness.
So we sent the body back to Ipoh.
Okay.
And we all went there.
Oh my goodness.
So
I'm so sorry to hear about your brother, but
you were saying the mindful breathing.
Yes.
Helps me a lot.
Okay, very good.
My other brothers and sisters, they're having a hard time.
Yeah.
So I was a little bit better.
Having a hard time coping and everything? Yeah, that's right.
That's where
it really comes home, isn't it? You know, when you experience that kind of loss and that kind of grief, and you just don't know how it's going to affect you. But at least when we have some meditation, we have something, right? And we at least have something we can hold on to, something that gives us some solace.
Yeah, it was okay. And I think since
then,
some
chanting. Oh, that's so sweet.
It was good.
Oh, very thoughtful of him. When I was staying in Ipoh, I stayed there for like more than a year, but the main family who supported me was the family of Now Ayahasapanya, who's the abbot at Dhammasara Monastery. So all of her Sui Tan, Sui Ha, Sui Ping, all of the Suis, there's like four of them, four Suis who came. And then the brothers, like two or three brothers and so on, and they came and they would come like this. The three sisters would come every day to bring dana. And when there was another monk in town, they would also bring dana to him every day. And so they have, and also working full-time jobs as well. So Sui Ping, now Ayasapanya, she was running a bakery business at the time. And so, you know, it's a lot of work, right? Early hours, all of this kind of thing. So she would get up early in the morning, go and do the bakery. Then when that was done, she'd come to the monastery, offer dana, cook the food, offer dana, do some meditation. She got some time, went back, worked on the thing. And then in the evening would do the rounds, like she had deliveries and stuff, and get back home, cook food for her old dad, and then meditate. Yes.
To go to the Thailand, Greek island, that's, you know, quite hard to understand.
I don't, why is that hard to understand? But I, well, the point I was trying to, I was about to get around to with that. So all of this family and all of them so devoted, and the reason why they were so devoted was because of the loss of their mother. And their mum died. And they were just all so distraught, and the whole lot of them completely no context, no understanding, because it's just like, why? You know, you just want to know why. So that's how they turned to Buddhism, and that's how they all became so interested in Buddhism. Yeah.
I think it's more accepting.
More accepting, yeah.
Buddhism, maybe teaches more accepting.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's right, more accepting, more letting go, more kind of emotional groundedness, so that we don't get so blown about by all of these things. Yeah. The Buddha said to be peaceful amongst the agitated, yeah, to be full of love amidst those who are hating. And that's something that we can do. And you know, if you're other people in your family who are your brothers and sisters who are meditating, who are practitioners?
Yes, a few of them.
A few of them, yeah.
Some are. Like my brother, he's classifying himself as a free thinker.
Free thinker.
Yeah, but we had a beautiful sort of ceremony where we just do chanting.
Yeah.
Before we used to burn, maybe you know, those paper things.
Ah, yes, yes.
But now a lot of them have changed to just very peaceful chanting.
Okay. So just for those online, she was talking about how their family, they used to burn all of the paper things at the ceremonies. I'm sure most of you are familiar with that kind of Chinese practice. So you burn whatever you have that's valuable. Sorry?
Lanterns?
No, you make things that you want to have when you're in heaven.
iPhone.
You might burn your iPhone. Yeah, you make like a Mercedes-Benz. Or anything like that, and then you can sort of buy these things, and I think they're quite expensive to buy, and then burn them up, and then they go to heaven, and then you can enjoy them when you're in heaven. Yeah. So they say. Right? So all of these things can get quite complicated. I mean, in a way, it's kind of the opposite of what the Buddha said. You know, the Buddha said, when you die, then that's the time to let go. Not the time to and be thinking, I'm going to have an iPhone when I'm in heaven. Like, why though? Well, the point I was going to make was that, you know, if you're someone who has that spiritual practice and has some groundedness, then that's a gift that you can give also to your brothers and sisters. You know, and I don't mean that you have to like convert them or, you know, make them meditate or whatever. If they're interested, that's great. But just through your presence and just through being somebody who can be mindful, be aware, and not be swamped, not be overwhelmed. That's like that's a really kind of valuable gift. It's one of those things that's really valuable. But people might not notice it. That's why I find it's important to mention it. You know, like if you're like at a funeral or something like that, and then somebody's weeping, then everybody notices that. you know. But not everybody is doing that. And there are some people who are managing to keep that sense of calm. And that is something that really really holds things together in that quiet way. Yeah. I'm so sorry for your loss. It's really terrible. But look,
he's very much younger, so you can understand you're all
worried
now.
it can happen. It can happen at any age. It can happen at any age, yeah. At least he was doing something that he loved.
It was just 2 more days to finish the tour.
No. Yeah.
Maybe he was in his happy place.
Yeah.
So what would you want?
That's how I do
want a peaceful state without destruction.
Yeah.
That's how everyone consoled his wife.
If I had a choice, I'd choose that. And been eaten by a shark. Wasting time and swimming in the water.
Yeah, those islands are beautiful, but medical wise, like ambulance wise, they're slow
right.
To get there.
Right. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So we can't say when it will happen, and the only thing that we can say is that it will happen.
Yeah, all my brothers and sisters are like, let's get things ready.
So we've got a couple of questions from folks online. Tamara has asked about something about midlife crisis in the Dhamma. Okay, good question. So midlife crises are good, actually. So what we call a midlife crisis is really just a kind of one variety of the kind of more general phenomenon of the existential crisis, right? So you go through phases in your life every so often where you're like, what's this all about? What does this all mean? And, you know, what am I going to do with my life now? And I remember it happens when you're younger, it happens when you're middle life, it happens towards the end of your life as well. You know, one time one of my students at I used to come to Santi a lot, and she came, and her daughter had just graduated and moved out of home. And so, like, you know, now her husband and her were the only ones left. And she's like, what do I do with my life now? It's a big change. I said to her, look, you know, what my recommendation? I said, get a leather jacket, a motorbike, take up smoking, and just raise hell and see what happens. So anyway, the next time she came back, she had on a leather jacket and a packet of cigarettes. Sometimes just to do something different, you know, and it's a kind of cliche about a midlife crisis. That's what you do, right? I mean, if you're a bloke, you get a man cave and a drum kit or something like that, and you make a bunch of noise. That's all right. So the point is that life does change, and then that's something which was one of the sayings of Jung, Carl Jung, the psychologist, that really stuck with me. I can only paraphrase it. It's many years since I read it, but he said something like that: a man who lives in his middle age and in his old age by the same values that he lived with in his youth as somebody who hasn't grown. And that's something which has really kind of stuck with me. And that's a perspective that Jung brought into psychology, because before him, Freud mostly emphasized that we're shaped by the experiences we had when we were kids, right? Obviously, we have formative experiences when we're kids. Obviously, that influences us. But at the same time, what Jung was pointing out was that, well, what you do when you're an adult matters. And the person that you become isn't just because of what happened to you when you were a kid. The person that you become, it depends on how you live your life as an adult. Actually, that's the most important thing. And so we shouldn't be afraid to face up to these crises and see them as a time for growth. Now, of course, sometimes it can be traumatic because you have like a conflict between what are the external constraints placed on you and what is your own individual development, right? Maybe you've got a mortgage, you have to keep paying your mortgage, but then you're thinking, oh, I don't really like my career, I want to do something different. But then how do you do that? Because you've got to actually pay the bills, you know, or maybe you have family, or maybe whatever, you have these kinds of obligations. So there can be that tension between, you know, what that inner growth is and the external growth is. That's not a bad thing. That's actually really important, because real growth happens in that tension. If you were in a situation where you didn't have that tension, okay, then you would just indulge your whims and actually you wouldn't really be taking any risk. This is what people do if they're like super rich or something like that. They don't have to worry about that, paying the mortgage or do this and that. They want to go on retreat, go and find some guru, do this and that, and they can do that. But none of it actually means anything because it doesn't have any cost. And so the fact that there's that tension in there actually is what makes it worthwhile. That's the kind of the grit in it that makes it matter. So there are a few things that we can do. Number one, if you're going through something like this, communicate, especially if you're in a marriage or some kind of relationship, talk to each other about it. And remember that if that's happening to you or if that's happening to your partner, that we have individual lives and growths as well as a relationship. And not everything is about the fact of the relationship, that we are growing also as individuals and people. And we don't know where that journey is going to take us. So we can support each other on that journey, right? Without judging, without feeling threatened, without thinking, oh, you know, you're becoming a different person or anything like that. It's your job to help each other and support each other to do that. Yeah? So that's number one thing that you can do. Number two thing you can do is, well, no matter what your age is, don't be afraid to take some risks. It's okay. You know, take some leave from work, go off and travel, just do something that's different. Break up your schedule, you know, take up some kind of new skill or whatever. Try doing something new. Now, obviously, if we're spiritual practitioners and we're meditators, then, you know, the thing we're most likely to think of is maybe, oh, look, I want to go to, you know, Sri Lanka, or I want to go to Thailand, or I want to do some retreat and stay in a monastery. And that can be a great option, because when you do that, especially when you're as a visitor staying in monasteries, then usually your space, your time is very open. Like, you have that support around you, but you don't really have a lot of expectations. I mean, you're just someone who rolled up, who's staying there for a while. You know, you've probably got some simple duties and things like that, but then you're actually really free to explore, you know, doing your meditation, doing a study or something like that. So that can be a really good option for somebody who's having a midlife crisis. And in fact, that is one of the major functions that monasteries have, you know. And when I was at, I remember when I was at my dad's place one time years ago in Coffs Harbour, one of his neighbours was the singer, Wendy Matthews, who some of you may remember, R&B singer, jazz singer. Anyway, she came round and she was, you know, interesting to talking and stuff like that. And she talked about the time she'd been to stay at a monastery. She went to stay at Sunyataram down in Bundanoon. She said, oh, yeah, I remember that time I went down there. I had a bad perm and PMS, and I went down and just cried for 3 days. And that was my stay in the monastery. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's a perfect reason to go and stay in a monastery, you know, just to have that kind of break. And just be able to spend that time. That's why we have these things. Yeah? So don't be afraid to just go and take a break, you know. But maybe being in a monastery isn't your thing, right? Maybe just go and walk around, or maybe just go and stay somewhere else, whatever. So, but the whole point in Jungian psychology, they sort of understand this as kind of like venturing into the wilderness. Yeah? And it might be a literal wilderness, which is great if you can do that, right? And the thing about it is that in that wilderness, there's no boundaries, there's no walls. So this is what essentially is going on. Like, you build your life with all of these structures, and those structures are my career, my relationship, my habits, you know, things that I like, things that I don't like, things that I tell myself I can do and things that I tell myself I can't do. And all of these things kind of define who you are as a person. So when you come to an existential crisis, you let those things go, and you let them all just dissolve. And the deeper you let them dissolve, right, then the more transformative it can be, right? If you let them dissolve just a little bit, then you have a little bit of transformation. If you let them dissolve a lot, then you have a lot of transformation. Of course, this is exactly what the Buddha did when he went forth from his home, left behind all of his expectations, relationships, duties, responsibilities, and just go into the forest. And you're literally just sitting there in the middle of this huge forest, saying to yourself, what the hell am I doing here? Right? I mean, can you imagine what that's like? I mean, it's challenging enough to go to a monastery or to go traveling or something, but imagine just like literally walking into the middle of a jungle with nothing but a couple of rags on your body, and there's elephants and tigers and all of this stuff around you, and you're just sitting there thinking, what? Right? So that's this kind of total kind of relinquishment of everything. Right? Now, what happens when you go through that kind of crisis? You feel free to let everything go, right? Afterwards, some things will come back. It's not like you become a completely different person after that has happened, right? Some things will come back. Maybe people around you won't even notice any difference. Yeah? Who knows? Yeah? But some things will change also. Some things will maybe grow in a different way. Maybe you have kind of new depths or new nuances. Maybe you'll be interested in things you weren't before. Maybe you will be in touch with your feelings in ways that you weren't before. Who knows, right? There's no set path that these things take, which is kind of the point. So midlife crisis, existential crisis, great. We should all try to have them on a fairly regular basis.
Vanaprastha thing, the forest
whale. Vanaprastha.
The Vedic Hindu thing, that's the third stage.
Right. Forest whale. That's right, yeah. So that's in the Vedic sort of traditions, they have this idea that you know you go and you spend some time in the forest and these kinds of things. So yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. So you just try to just relinquish everything. When I left Santi, I did this. So when I decided to retire from Santi, and we did this thing, we turned it over to Bhikkhunis and things like that, and I had no idea what I wanted to do, and I just like, oh, well, that's good, I'll just have no idea what I wanted to do. I went up and I spent the Vasa with my dad, just staying in the, he's got a little house out the back, and I just stayed there and just did a retreat. And then at the end of that, I caught a train down to Sydney, and I had no idea what I was going to do. I didn't call anybody, I didn't make any contacts. So I thought, I'll just come to Sydney and just be anonymous. Nobody will know me, and I'll just see what happens. So I get off the train, literally walk down the street, and there's Roy. And I bump into Roy. So, how's it going, Roy? Oh, yeah, how's it going, Bunda? So I don't know if he remembers that, but that's literally what happened. And... No, I just hung around Sydney for a while, went for Pindabhata, slept in the domain, slept by the observatory in the park there. There's the sighting. This.
You've sighted someone there. I think you saw somebody.
That was a long time ago. Maybe. Yeah. No, I wasn't. I didn't get as far as Bondi. So yeah, just did that for a few days, and then decided what I wanted to do, and then went and did that. So. Anyway, so it's good to do that from time to time. Good to throw things up, try something new. Don't be afraid to do it. And if that's happening to you, then you know, have the courage to do that. And if it's happening to somebody that you know, then give them some support and encouragement. Yeah, and maybe people feel like you feel like you're really frustrated, feel like you're stuck, feel like you're in a rut. It's okay. Let everything go, and then just see. Usually it'll be better. I mean, sometimes you might just go crazy or something like that. What's life without a risk every now and then, right? So yeah, if you're having a midlife crisis, good on you, Tamara. And we're all here for you, okay? So I think everybody here wishes you well. Have a good midlife crisis if that's happening to you, and just like go hard, you know, just like. Just like break down all those boundaries, let everything dissolve, and take as much time as you need for them to grow back up, and then see what kind of new, wonderful Tamara there is at the end of that process. Okay, great. So from the Santi Sangha, Nilu asks, oh, hey, Nilu, how are you going? Up there down at Santi. What's the right balance between contentment and proactively seeking to improve a situation? I'm afraid that there is no answer to that, Nilu. What's the right balance? The right balance is the balance that gets you has a good outcome. I guess if you do what you can and don't be too upset when you don't get what you want. One thing to bear in mind is that, you know, I'll just tell you a story one of the monks at Bodhinyana told me once. He said that before, if anybody's been to Bodhinyana, they'll know that, you know, normally you have this kind of system where the monks will come down from the top floor and then people will have bowls of rice and they'll do pindabhata and offer pindabhata to the rice and so on. And before they didn't do that, they did it another way. And then when they built the second floor in that building, then they had a discussion in the Sangha, how are we going to do the meal offering, right? Are we going to, like, people going to come and offer the food individually to us, or are we going to receive it here, or are we going to do this pindabhata or something like that? And, well, there were camps and there were factions and there were beliefs about which way it was going to work and which way it wasn't. I could say I wasn't there, so this is something I heard secondhand. And one of the monks was telling me, he said, I was so convinced that it just wouldn't work doing it this way. You know, it's just too complicated. People won't have time, won't work out. And I had all of these reasons why this wasn't going to happen. And then we did it and it was all fine. So, oh, and he's like, oh, this, and it's like the next day, he's like, oh, yeah, actually, it's a good idea. We should have. So just remember that when, you know, when you want to argue something or push for something, great. You know, you have your values and you want to push for something that, as best you can. But just remember, you're not always right. Other people have a valid point of view as well. Maybe you are right. You know, maybe that's the best point of view. But at the same time, you know, it's okay. The world goes on. And maybe sometimes it's good to learn from losing and learn from seeing what other people want to do as well. So, just try to do what you can and then let go. Yeah, but if you find that it's causing yourself too much suffering and too much stress, then that's probably, you know, a bit of stress every now and then, never mind. But if it's too much, then that's probably not a good idea. Okay, Jose asks another question. Okay, we are not supposed to have blonde faith in the Dhamma. And now, I don't know if this blonde faith is like, if the reference, I don't know if it's a reference to the whole Aryan thing. Is that connected to the whole Aryan? I don't know. But anyway, blonde faith in the Dhamma, but to experience it, okay? Can we learn from experience about, blind faith. Can we learn from experience about the different realms, heaven and hell and so on? Okay, very good. Okay, fine. Okay. Good question. Okay, so actually that question is brought up in the suttas themselves. Actually, it's discussed as a conversation. Let me see if I can find the actual sutta. Give me one second. I'll use our fancy new search on Sutta Central. Let's see if it'll give me what I want. There's a conversation with Siha, the general. Still having trouble with the things, general. Maybe there. No, can't find it too quickly. But anyway, conversation with Siha, the general, who basically asked this exact same question. They said, "What's the benefits of giving?" And the Buddha gave, I think, five reasons, benefits of giving. One was it makes you happy, it makes others happy, it makes you feel confident. When you walk into an assembly and associate with people and so on. And then the last one he said was that you go to heaven when you die. And see, his response was, he said, well, you know, these first four benefits, you know, I'm a generous person and I can see those benefits for myself. I can see that it makes me happy. I can see that it makes me confident. I can see all of these things apply. But that last one you mentioned about going to heaven, he says, I can't really see that for myself. So I'll have to take that on faith. And the Buddha said, okay, yes, you have to take that on faith. So this is the role of faith in Buddhism. So again, it's not blind faith, but reasoned faith. Yeah? If the Buddha got 4 out of 5, right, okay, and your experience doesn't cover number 5, then it's reasonable to have faith in that. That doesn't mean that it's necessarily 100% true. Maybe it's wrong, but you know, you sort of take that up as being the what seems like a reasonable belief at that time. So this is the kind of attitude that we have towards in Buddhism, and you know, don't. You know, it's easy to fall in with Buddhism into sort of an overly kind of literalist and overly fundamentalist take on the Dhamma and so on, you know, and if you hang around in Buddhist circles for long enough, you know, you'll hear about people who will be strenuously arguing that it really is a rabbit on the moon, that when we see the shape of the rabbit, there's like an actual rabbit there, and these kinds of things. And that's a Jataka story about the why this is, whatever. So just hold it lightly, you know, and use the Dhamma without fear and without insistence. The important things of the Dhamma are the Four Noble Truths, and that's the things that we can really see and experience. If there are other things we can't see, then maybe we'll learn about them later on. And of course, we all have experienced that in life, that the things that initially thought we couldn't understand them, later we see that they are. And in that way, the Buddha's teaching is really no different from anything else, you know. And so this whole kind of this whole Western idea of like the opposition between faith and science, it really doesn't apply to Buddhism. And it's really important to not get caught into these kinds of extremes. I mean, consider if you're a physicist, right? What are you doing if you're a physicist? Well, you know, I'm going to take Einstein on faith. I'm going to take, you know, Niels Bohr on faith. I mean, I'm not going to personally do every experiment to prove whether, you know, the curvature of space-time as predicted by Einstein's general theory of relativity is really accurate. I mean, I'm just going to take that on faith and I'm going to do the experiment that I'm actually doing. But if there is something that disproves it, well, then it can be disproven. And so it's that same kind of thing. But it's also true in physics that if you do want to test it, well, it doesn't just mean that I can just do a doodle on the back of my notebook and then prove whether it's right or not. Right? I mean, if I think, is quantum theory really true? Well, number one, get a degree. Number two, get another degree. Number three, get another degree. And when you've got your doctorate, then start the real work, then do some experiments, and then build like a $20 billion particle accelerator or something like that, and then kind of do these experiments, and then maybe you can do it. You know, to be provable or testable doesn't mean that it's just easy to do. So these days, a lot of people say, do the research. Right? I hate this with a fiery passion, okay? If anybody tells you, do the research, what that tells you is, more than anything else, is that they have no idea what research is, okay? They have no idea what research is, and what they mean is faff about on the internet. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to faff about on the internet and read some dumb blogs or watch some idiot on YouTube and say, oh, I've done the research. No, that's not what doing the research is, right? If I want to say I know better than all the scientists about what the COVID vaccine is or something, you want to know better than that? Great. Okay, here's your first step. Number one, get a medical degree. Number two, get a biochemistry degree. Number three, do a research program. Number four, do some mentorship under somebody who knows what they're doing. Number five, get some funding for some experiments. Number six, publish some peer-reviewed articles, okay? And then if you've done those things, okay, maybe you can have a conversation about what you're talking about. But if you haven't done those things, you're just blowing hot air, okay? So just be normal. I'm begging you, be normal. You know, don't get caught up in all of these kinds of things. You know, some years ago I was in Canberra, I was doing a thing for climate change. We were at Parliament House and we did a thing begging our government to please don't murder the future to death. And unsuccessful, of course, but and the press was there and they did some interviews and stuff like that. And at the same time, one of the issues that was in the papers was some immigration law or reform or something. And so one of the journalists said to me, oh, you know, can I get you a statement on this immigration law from a Buddhist point of view? I said, well, I don't know anything about it. She said, well, just give us your opinion. I don't know enough to be able to have an opinion that's worth listening to. And the journalist was like, this was not an attitude that she encountered often, you know, that actually, why should anybody be listening to me when I don't know what I'm talking about? Yeah. So just be normal. Okay, I've got a bit off track here, but the point originally was about the having faith, right? So when we do things, we have to have faith in things all the time. We have to have faith just to be able to live. You know, we've got faith that this building isn't going to fall down. We've got faith that we turn the switch and the light is going to go on. You know, we have faith that, you know, if there's a car coming down the opposite laneway, that they're not going to swerve into us and kill us. You know, we have faith in other people and other things all of the time. But we have reasoned faith and not blind faith. So it's really, Buddhism is really no different there. All right. Okay, so Sumana asks, what's the difference between right thought and wisdom? Aha. Simple difference would be that right thought is something that you can do, whereas wisdom is something that you grow into. So you can't have wisdom or do wisdom, but wisdom is something that grows through all of the things that you think, all of the things that you do. And in particular, wisdom is something that emerges from how you encounter the world and how you actually live things. And come back to science as another example. You know, people have this idea of science as like a set of theories or like a method or all of these kinds of things. But actually all of those scientific theories and all of that scientific method is completely meaningless unless it actually does something in the real world. That's what distinguishes science. It's not that it's got better theories than anybody else. It's that when you use those theories, you can build a plane and it actually stays up in the air. And that's incredible. Yeah? And that's how we know that science works, because we apply it and we actually see the results. So same thing with right thought and wisdom, right? So we can think about things, we can learn things, we can do all of these kinds of things, and we can have all of these kinds of theories about things. But until it's actually applied in something that matters, like the loss of someone in your family, right? Like the actual finding meaning and finding value in your life, then you'll be able to see whether that right thought has really matured into wisdom. Okay, so that's on right thought and wisdom. Good, some good questions today, right? Some good questions. Anyone else? You have a question, Pam?
Yeah. I'm just trying to understand dukkha.
Okay. Okay.
And especially in Buddhism, it's like really talked about, but in a lot of other religions, they don't talk about dukkha a lot, and in a lot of religions, life is supposed to be beautiful. And
right? Life. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's quite the opposite. And so a lot of people don't think that they're suffering, and they don't feel that they're suffering. So is that just a mental state? Or?
Okay. Okay, so the question was asked about dukkha, about whether dukkha is a universal condition or whether it's a mental state. Yeah. So according to Buddhism, it's a universal condition. So everything is suffering all the time. Okay, but that, of course, doesn't mean that things aren't also pleasant. It doesn't mean that there's no joy or anything like that. It just means that those things are sometimes impermanent or something like that. So dukkha is a very broad and very pervasive thing. It encompasses, obviously, like real suffering, real pain and suffering, but also like we were talking about earlier, like having an existential crisis, right? This is another kind of suffering. It's more like a feeling of unease or something like that. You mentioned that in some religions, people don't talk about our suffering and so on, yeah? So that kind of really depends, right? And I can only really speak a little bit about my own experience with Christianity, brought up as a Catholic. And like one of the things that I think that it's really easy to overlook is the extent to which Christianity has changed in modern Christianity from what it was not that long ago. And I think personally, and this is obviously probably most Christians would disagree with this, but personally I think that by far the most influential person in the creation of modern Christianity is Nietzsche, the German philosopher. So Nietzsche came along and said, basically Christianity is a death cult which is obsessed with negativity and with grinding down the individual into nothing and turning you into a worm in the sight of God so that you have to be redeemed. And he contrasted this with what he knew, which was not necessarily that accurate, but also wasn't completely inaccurate, but with what he knew of Indian religions, Hinduism and Buddhism, which he saw as being paths that empowered individuals to find their own way. Right? So based on this idea that, you know, we can find our own wisdom and so on and so forth, and we're not waiting to be redeemed by God. Now, Nietzsche's critique, of course, was talking about the Christianity that he saw around him. His father was a pastor. And so, you know, you might disagree with him, but clearly there's something to that, you know. And when I went to visited, I got some idea of what this was like when I visited Vienna, and I went with dear Esther and we went to visit the catacombs at the cathedral there. And you go into the catacombs and it's like bones and death everywhere. And you realize, oh yeah, actually, kind of is a death cult, actually. There is something to this idea. And so, of course, modern Christianity is not really like that at all, right? And you wouldn't know that at all if you go to Hillsong. It's a complete opposite, yeah? And I believe that's because they, you know, they all kind of anathemized Nietzsche and said he's a heretic and stuff. But I think secretly they're like, yeah, actually, he's actually right. And they changed the way they did Christianity. And so these days Christianity is much more positive and so on. So I think he's actually, Nietzsche actually ended up being the most beneficial positive force for modern Christianity. Which he would like really hate that. exactly. So, but anyway, so my point here is that that understanding of dukkha is found in different religions. Yeah, but the way that it's encountered and the way that it's practiced can be very different. That's the same also in Buddhism as well. So you find like some forms of Buddhism are much more emphasizing the side of joy and so on, and others are much more dukkha, dukkha, got to do the hard work and so on. Yeah. So, you know, so sometimes that's personality as well. It's not necessarily one thing is right or one thing is wrong, but there is something which is foundational, and that is that if you believe in God, right, if you believe that there is a fundamentally beneficent divinity who created the world, then you have to at some level think that the world is basically good. Yeah? The world has to be son of good because God made it. And so for all those religions, this is why the problem of evil is a very difficult problem. How do you explain the presence of evil in the world if God is good and God created the world? And this of course is a classical philosophical problem. For Buddhism, the problem of evil is not a problem at all. We're like, yeah, actually it's just dukkha. The world is actually dukkha. Yeah. So you mentioned about like some people don't really think that they're suffering. I don't really believe that they're suffering. So what should we do in that case? If people don't believe that they're suffering, say, great, good on you. Have a nice life, you know? If you change your mind, we'll be here. Right? You can't, you know, if people are happy, it's good. There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah, it's good to be happy. You know, but sometimes it's because people genuinely are happy. Sometimes it's because there's like this veneer and there's sort of actually a lot of anxiety and so on underneath, and one day that's going to crack. The fact that that's there is not a problem, but just be open, you know? And if people want to talk about it and so on, then just be open, be ready for it, yeah.
So if someone like an arahant,
do
they actually suffer?
Does an arahant suffer? Yes, an arahant suffers. Yes, yeah, suffers all kinds of stuff. Bloody hell. Okay, number one. Okay, they got number one. How does an arahant suffer? Number one, they got all these students that keep asking all of these questions all the time. Right? I mean, come on. Okay, no, I'm only kidding. Only kidding. Come on. Bloody hell, only kidding. Only kidding. No. Okay, so the Buddha analyzed suffering to three kinds of suffering, right? So dukkha-dukkha, this is the intrinsic suffering. Sankhara-dukkha, the suffering of conditions, and viparinama-dukkha, the suffering of change. Arahants suffer all three of those things, all three of those kinds of suffering. Dukkha-dukkha is intrinsic suffering. So dukkha-dukkha is divided into mental suffering and physical suffering, right? Mental pain and physical same. Arahants don't have mental pain. Okay, so they don't get depressed, they don't get anxious, and those kinds of things. But they still have physical pain, right? They still get sick and it hurts, right? It's not that they don't have any pain, but they don't worry about the fact that it hurts. It just hurts, yeah? So there's that. Then there's the viparinama dukkha, which is the suffering of change. Now, this is very subtle. Suffering of change isn't, okay? So when most people think about suffering of change, what they think is, I had something and then I lost it and then I felt sad about that, right? But that's not what it means at all, because that's intrinsic suffering. That's dukkha-dukkha. If you feel sad about it, then that's dukkha-dukkha. So arahants don't have that. The suffering of change is much more subtle than that. Suffering of change is that I'm eating an ice cream and I have the first taste and it's so delicious. And I have the second taste, and it's a little bit less delicious than the first one. Just a little bit, okay? And it's not painful, not yet, right? If you keep eating too much, then maybe it'll be dukkha-dukkha, maybe it'll be painful. But it's only the second lick of the ice cream cone. It's not quite as nice as the first one. It's still nice. You're not experiencing any pain. But that's the viparinama dukkha, the suffering of change. More spiritually, that would be experienced, for example, if somebody goes from, let's say, a higher meditation state to a lower one, right? Maybe go from fourth jhana to third jhana, right? From that perspective, third jhana is it's still pretty good, it's great, but it's not quite as good as fourth jhana, right? This is the suffering of change. Finally, then there's the suffering of conditions, sankhara dukkha. So basically that's suffering that nothing is as peaceful as nibbana. So even if you're in a deep meditation, right, there's still that very kind of subtle underlying fact that you're in the conditioned realm and it's not as peaceful as nibbana, that's sankhara dukkha. So actually arahants still experience all three of those kinds of suffering. What they don't experience is the mental dimension of the intrinsic suffering. Yeah.
So arahants don't have negative emotions.
They don't have negative emotions, yeah. They don't get jealous, they don't get angry, don't get upset.
Yeah. They have positive emotions.
They do, yeah. They have metta, they have karuna, they have all these things, yeah.
So it actually doesn't mean that they suffer all these
That's right. It doesn't bother them, yeah. So they have those things, and they know it. And Sariputta described it as I'm just mindfully biding my time, like a workman waiting for his wages. Yeah, neither loathing life nor longing for death. I'm just biding my time, like a workman waiting for his wages.
So now I'm considering outsourcing.
Sure. Sure, why not? Yeah. Yeah, Dan, yeah.
Okay, with the suffering of change, wouldn't that be that, one of the problems is this clinging to the thing that's fundamentally uncontrollable and unstable and always changing.
Right.
Like, so with the ice cream example, the second one tastes a little, not as great as the first one, because right. The mind sort of attached to some sort of sign or some sort of idea of the flavor as an object.
Okay.
And it was never such a thing in the first place. So if we didn't have ignorance about the ice cream, we would see that it's just uncontrollable the whole time anyway. That's anatta, right? It's just out of control, changing. And the suffering was caused by our clinging to an object or an item, like a sign of this.
So if the suffering is caused by the clinging, then that would be the mental suffering, which would be the dukkha-dukkha. So Viparinama Dukkha is not that. Okay, the suffering of change is not that.
Yeah, so
it's not the suffering of the fact that we think that it shouldn't change. It's just the fact, the raw fact of change itself.
Is old age like that?
Yeah.
So it's the changing of your mind or changing of the ice cream?
Anything.
Both are changing.
Yeah, both are changing, yeah.
So what is the mind mean?
You know that Zen story, right? When the flag blows in the wind, what is it moving? What is it that's moving? Do you know that one?
Yes.
What is it that moves? Both. His Zen monk came to see Ajahn Chah one day and he said to him, "Great master, when a flag waves in the wind, what is it that moves? Is it the flag that moves or the wind that moves?" And Ajahn Chah said, "Neither, it's the mind that moves." And the Zen student said, "Sadhu, sadhu, oh, one of great wisdom." He said, "Nah, I just read it in a book the other day." That's right, yeah, Ajahn Brahm says it's the mouth that moves. Yeah. So change itself, any change, right? So the point is that the raw fact of change, not our ideas about change, not our response to change, not the thing that comes to change, simply the fact that things change itself is a kind of dukkha.
About anicca, vata, sankhara, and then it's like tesamsa pasamosa kuru.
Yeah.
Like, all things are impermanent. One who realizes this is happy. I mean, I thought that's one of the things that was a consequence of that birth.
Right, so the sankhara, anicca vata sankhara, is the anicca in of all sankharas, of course, is parinibbana.
Like, yeah,
so that's the end of the arahant's life.
Yeah.
Te sangu pasamo sukho. So then there's no suffering. So parinibbana, there's no suffering. But during the lifetime of the arahant, the five khandhas are still here.
Assume Arya would not have clinging, so they would know not to bother trying to control anything to do with
the
changing
stuff. Sure, which would create dukkha, mental suffering. But the stuff itself is still intrinsically dukkha. The raw fact of it is still dukkha, regardless of what you think
yes,
about
okay,
it.
Okay, like there's a
right
in the field.
Exactly. It's not, just think about that. It's not as peaceful as Nibbana, yeah? Leanne.
Each one of the clubs said, I was only going on thinking that what you were saying, it's all a part of the precepts of desires, attraction and clinging.
Right.
So the ice cream situation is.
Yeah, so look, and look, it's fine, right? The fact that the second lick of the ice cream is not as good as the first one is fine. You can live with that, right? But the point being that it's still not as peaceful as Nibbana, that's all. Yeah. So this is, we're getting very, very subtle.
So I guess maybe that's it with the ice cream thing. Like, it's inevitable, right?
Apologies to any vegans for this talk.
There's vegan
ice cream. Vegan. Oh, so soy ice cream.
Leather jacket. Leather jacket earlier was...
That's correct, yeah. Sorry.
Because like, if you keep eating your ice cream and then after a while, of course, you're going to get full, and that's just that's inevitable. So, I mean, of course, it's not going to feel comfortable anymore after a while.
Which would be dukkha. That's not the suffering of change, that's the intrinsic suffering, right? If you eat so much that it becomes, you get a stomach ache or whatever.
That's inevitable.
Yeah, so then.
So that's dukkha.
That's dukkha, yeah? That's the pain that comes as a consequence of it. See, it's very subtle, yeah? Sorry?
Marginal
utility, right, diminishing marginal utility. That's right, yeah, I mean, that's in economics, right? I mean, that's a principle in economics, diminishing marginal utility, and that's basically viparinama dukkha. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So one more question. So the Santi Sangha has asked, and I'm not sure who's asking from there, should we have hope? And I honestly don't know why you would ask me a question like that, but the answer is no, you should not, okay? Why not? Why not have hope? Because hope's all about the future, which is out of your control. So you can only worry about the present. That's all you can do. Yeah. Can't hope be in the present? Sure, I mean, the hope itself is in the present, but hope as an idea is kind of, it's intrinsically orientated to the future, right? There's no concept of hope in Buddhism. In Christianity, you have faith, hope, and charity. In Buddhism, you have faith and charity. You don't have hope. It's very freeing. Yeah, give up hope. It's so lovely. Yeah. See, it's the whole thing with Christianity, right? I mean, when Jesus died, everyone was like, oh, he's coming back, you know? And everyone was like, you know, well, let's wander around, tell everybody, well, Jesus will be back, and he'll be back soon. No, seriously, he's coming back. And so then you have this kind of, you have this messianic philosophy, which is orientated to the future, like there will be a saviour, and this is where that idea of hope comes from. So from a Buddhist point of view, no, that's not how it works. We have the present. We can act in the present. That's what we can do. What we have faith in is that if we act well in the present, then that will create good conditions for the future. But we don't act well in the present because we hope for good conditions in the future. We act well in the present because it's good to act well in the present. That way, that's really good, because that way the future isn't going to disappoint you. Because I'm tell you what, future is going to disappoint you. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I was growing up, I thought we'd all have like bloody flying backpacks by now. I thought we'd all be like exploring the galaxies and all of that kind of stuff. No. Instead, we've got... It bloody did, didn't it? I saw that. Machine killed somebody, yeah, just like a mistake in the thing and then in the factory and then crushed someone. Yeah, it's not good. So it's the beginning. That's the beginning, I'm warning you. Okay. Okay, fine. Let us wrap up for tonight. Thanks, everybody, for coming along. And... stay faithful. Nirasa, free of hope. One of the terms of the Arahat. Nirasayam, free of hope. Ah, so peaceful, so nice. And see you next week. Oh, just a reminder that we are here every Friday night in Harris Park at this web address for those online. And we're also in... Crow's Nest at the Crow's Nest Centre, 7 p.m. Wednesday nights, okay? And that's an in-person only event. So if you're around or if you know anybody in the North Sydney area, then do let them know about the Crow's Nest event, 7 p.m. on a Wednesday night at the Crow's Nest Centre. Thanks, everybody.